world of specialists, generalists sometimes seem like people without a country. That may be changing. In an age of specialized and increasingly powerful AI tools, going broad rather than narrow may increasingly be valuable. Today on Hardly Working, Vikram Mancharamani returns to the podcast to discuss his personal and professional journey as a self-described generalist. His recent memoir, The Making of a Generalist, narrates his journey from a kid curious about everything to one of the nation's most sought-after thinkers and advisors on questions of calling and career. We hope you enjoy this conversation.
Vikram Mancharamani, welcome to Hardly Working, or I should say welcome back to Hardly Working.
I'm thrilled to be back.
I don't know if you know this, but you were our all-time highest listened to in your initial recording, in your first recording with us, that we are here to give the people what they told us they wanted, which was more of you.
Wonderful. Well, that's great to hear. I'd love to hear more feedback on that at some point, but let's not use this podcast to sort of describe that one. We'll let people listen to that one and we'll talk about this later.
Yeah. Yeah. So great to have you. And you've got a new book out. Normally in these podcasts, I make the guests sort of reveal their deepest, darkest secrets about themselves in the first couple of minutes. But since you've already done that, we won't do it again. If you're listening, you want to hear about Vikram's background, you can look up his prior podcast on Hardly Working, and you can hear about it there. But as I said, people really loved the conversation last time, and I'm sure they're going to love this one, too. But I wanted to get right into the book. I'd like you to talk about the generalist and where it came from. Why did you write this? And what are you trying to tell people?
Yeah, well, Brent, thanks for asking the question. I mean, the book is really my version, a written version, if you will, of therapy that I had to undergo after running for office. So let me just admit what it is right there at the get-go. It's not a deep, dark secret. It's just a reality. As you might recall, Brent, I ran for the U.S. Senate in New Hampshire during the 2022 cycle. And in the Republican primary was unsuccessful. I think I handled myself well, and it was my first time ever running for office. But it did lead to a lot of introspection after the fact. And it started with a little bit of, oh my God, did I fail? What did I do? I was trying to do something good for the country. I'm now no longer teaching at Harvard. I was before. What happened? What did I do to myself? And I really felt like I had somehow dropped the ball on my career, dropped the ball by trying to do something positive. And I started by writing what became a, you know, probably 50, 60 page letter to my father, sort of thanking him, saying, look, you came to this great nation. What a gift you've given me for being born in America. Oh my goodness, the opportunities I've had. I avoided these labels. I've explored. I've had these really fulfilling experiences. And it's been an amazing run. And then I said, hey, he kind of knows this. He's not going to read it. So I said, let's get rid of that. I said, well, maybe I should write lessons learned about my life to date for my son. And I tried that and got pages, and I said, eh, he's not going to read that. And so I ultimately decided, let me take this kernel of ideas, sort of what I've experienced in this great nation, and combine it with some of my prior writings and thinking into something that offers something more general to a mass audience. And so what ended up happening was we took some of the autobiographical experiences from those letters, what I've learned along the way, how I was pushed in certain directions, what I observed along the way of being pushed with these labels, and how I resisted them to be a generalist in a land of specialists, trying to connect dots when others were asking me to generate dots. And I said, let's take that and combine it with the frameworks from my prior books. So just a quick recollection or quick recap here. My first book, Boom Bustology, was about financial bubbles. And I used the idea that multiple lenses when you look through psychology, politics, in addition to economics and finance, that you might see a bubble, an uncertain phenomenon, if you will, before others do if they're only looking through one lens. I took that logic further in the book called Think for Yourself, which was our prior podcast, and that was really about utilizing multiple perspectives to triangulate for tough decisions, whether it's around your career, whether it's around your medical decision or financial, personal finance decision or whatever, you'd get better insights by looking through multiple perspectives. And so when I ended up in this political sphere running, everyone wanted to categorize me in one dimension, right or left. And it somehow struck me as odd. Everything I've done, the insights I've developed in my life as a generalist, were formed because I was triangulating multiple perspectives.
So let me ask you that something about that experience of having, you know, people needing to have you fit into this box or one of two boxes. You're either left or you're right. Is that a product of the age that we live in?
Yeah. I think it is. I think it's partially a sorting mechanism that's taken – a result of sorting that's happened, right? So we've now – and there's been lots written about this. I mean, Robert Putnam's written, I think, eloquently on, you know, the social breakdowns and things like, you know, bowling alone or, you know, what's happened with the economic stratification rather than community-based sort of interactions with our kids and other books. But even The Upswings was more optimistic about it. So I think – others have written about this sorting that's taken place. What I would suggest is the social media, the segmentation of media generically has been driven by business models, Brent. Let's be honest, like clicks and attention are what their business models are based on. And so how do you get that? You give people what they want, not what they need. And so what people want is confirmation that their ideas are right. They want to see things that inflame the things that they're already inflamed about, right? And so those are the business models of the social media enterprise. And so people get confirmation throughout their worlds and they start believing that. They get bigger convictions on it rather than what I think a generalist logic supports and promotes, which is a little bit of humbleness, which is I don't know everything. I'm a generalist. You might know more about that topic than I do. So I listen more. Right? I ask more questions. I think that's part of the story. But I do think the filtering that takes place by interest – look, it happens on cable TV. You're a sci-fi fan? You get a sci-fi channel. You want sports, only PGA sports, golf in warm climates with palm trees visible. There's a channel for that, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas
– yeah, I often think about this, you know, the big question, did social media do this to us, or my own conviction on it is that the masterminds behind social media just identified a market opportunity.
I think that's right.
And then created a mechanism for monetizing.
Yeah.
A pre-existing proclivity in the human mind to seek out like, to seek out like, and to you know, go deep inside something rather than broad, and be forced to grapple with, you know, things that are just complicated and hard and unsatisfying, which is most of life, actually.
Yeah, Brent, unfortunately, I think you're dead on. I don't think social media caused this. This was pre-existing. It intensified it. It maybe put it on steroids and pushed it. But look, cable was already segmenting people. Mm-hmm. Direct mail was segmenting people. We've always categorized people, mm-hmm. right? We've had our tribes, right? But this is a reality.
This is Madison Avenue. This is Mad Men. You know, it's the basis of all advertising. Is
bingo.
You can't. Yeah. 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 Okay. So how does a generalist contribute to getting out of this trap?
Well, what I've suggested is being broad, thinking widely in a time when others are more narrow, really is at some level, Brent, a generalist is one who exhibits empathy for perspectives other than their own in different domains. Right? I will walk into a room filled with experts and people who are narrow and deep that by nature is a little bit difficult, right? It's a little intimidating at times. Like, you walk into a room, and I did this when I was on the faculty at Harvard. You'd walk into a room and there'd be faculty members who were expert in every domain possible. There's not a domain possible out there in the room that I know more than they do. But I can connect the dots in ways they can't. It leads you to be a little more open-minded. It leads to more curiosity, I think. And so if all of us can become slightly more generalist in our approach, that will lead to slightly more empathy and respect, not necessarily agreement with perspectives other than your own. I mean, I've often said my antidote, for my simple antidote I give on, you know, in my public speaking engagements and some of the advice I offer students and large audiences is, look, we can complain about social media and saying this is being done to us, but there's an antidote that we can provide to ourselves. And that's simply to diversify our sources of information, diversify our media diet, actually consume information that you may not agree with, actually go in the directions that are uncomfortable. If you love Fox News and that's what you want to watch all day, great. Do me a favor. Turn on CNN for a little bit. You don't have to agree with it, but I want you to be aware of it. Right? Same thing. If you're a devout watcher of MSNBC, turn on Newsmax for a little bit. That's not saying you got to agree with it. You can disagree with it, but be exposed to it. Likewise, I tell people, read magazines, physical magazines, because you're not tunneling into your area of interest by doing a search online. You're being exposed to all different topics, flipping pages that you wouldn't otherwise see, even if it's just headlines. Same thing with newspapers. So anyway, I think you and I have talked about the fact that I'm antiquated in reading physical newspapers. But...
Not easy to find these days, actually. I mean, it's you gotta work, do a little work to actually get your hands on a newspaper. It's not easy to make the case for generalism in today's world, apart from sort of the reinforcing patterns that we have, or the reinforcing forces that we have that are pushing us into narrower and narrower lanes of information. There also isn't as much of an economic upside for the individual to be broad, or at least there's a perceived bias for specialization. It's a point I try to make often, which is, you know, the world actually may be headed in a direction where the powers of the generalist kind of reassert themselves. And I'm curious about your take on kind of, this is from like an education, training, employment standpoint.
Yeah. Look, I think it's crystal clear, even in my own experience over the last 25 or 30 years here, Brent, that specialists get paid more. The returns on specializing are higher. And I would say that's definitively true earlier in one's career. And it is questionable if it is true over the long run of one's career, meaning the slope of, if we wanted to plot, and I realize this is an audio show, so it's hard to, but I'll describe. If you were to plot the returns on returns to specialists, my guess is they're very steep initially in one's career. And then over time, I think they plateau. Whereas the generalist gets a different trajectory, which is flat initially, and then it sort of takes off and goes up over time. Because as you rise in seniority, as you rise in responsibility within your organizations or across organizations or in functions, suddenly that value of being a generalist is you have something which is not technical, which is not a skill, but is actually best categorized in one word, judgment. You actually develop judgment, nuance, the ability to handle uncertainty in ways that perhaps those who have been given a set of tools that they've mastered, they are running around, and I've used this analogy, I think, on our prior podcast. The specialist runs around holding a hammer. And you know what? They see a lot of nails. And by the way, when it's an actual nail, they're the best at hitting it. But when it's not a nail, they're not sure. Whereas a generalist is going to have that toolkit, and that in that toolbox, they've got a hammer, they've got a screwdriver, and they've got a wrench, for instance. So when they see a shiny thing with a flat top that looks slightly roundish and has a long spike underneath it, they're going to ask questions that a specialist might not. They're going to say, is there threading? Is there a slit on top? Because if there's a slit on top, I want to use a screwdriver, not a hammer. Is it a hexagon or an octagon on top? Maybe I need a wrench. Like, maybe that's saying something to me. You look in different ways at something that looks the same, and you come up with nuance. So I think a generalist logic actually makes for a more flexible labor pool. So teaching people how to learn, it sounds trite, sounds like the old liberal arts, oh, we're not going to teach you anything, we're going to teach you how to learn. But it's true, right? We live in a world that requires constant re-education, and especially in a time where artificial intelligence is removing expertise rapidly, or the value of expertise in narrow domains very rapidly, it is critical to be able to look across domains. Specifically for the labor pool that can do that, a more flexible labor pool is going to make America more competitive, and therefore there is an argument, I think, that we should all be constant learners, and being a constant learner is effectively being a generalist.
So, I mean, doesn't it irk you? You're a words person. You're a very talented writer and speaker. And doesn't it irk you that you spent all these years acquiring that skill, and now AI is coming along and with large language models that it's not as good as your writing. Of course, it's not as good as your writing.
Not yet.
But
not yet.
It allows the user to like skip a whole years and years of development to get something that kind of approximates what you can do.
Yeah. Look, I'm not sure it's irk's not the right word, Brent. So what I find
it irks me. Yeah. I'm just projecting my own irksomeness about this.
Yeah, so. I don't know if irk's the right word. I mean, I think I'm torn. I have a schizophrenic reaction to it. I love it at times and I hate it at times. So maybe I'm half irked and half, empowered. Because honestly, what I have found, for me, the hardest part of writing has always been getting the thoughts down. And then the craft occurs in the editing of the words once they're down, and the nuance of getting the language right. So if I can get the difficult part, a little assistance on that, and then spend what I find to be the valuable part of crafting the nuance of getting the tone right, getting the language, getting the conciseness, getting the getting that part of the writing right, well, that sort of makes me – that's sort of empowering to do that.
And right. No, it makes you more productive.
So I think there's something there. But here, you know what? This will be fun. I'll share with you. It's not a deep, dark secret, but it's just an experiment that's going on. So we have I've hired a team that's helped me upload every single one of my writings, every single piece of all the podcasts I've been on that are public, all the speeches we have on YouTube. And there is an ungodly amount of volume put into a large language model. And so there's a Vikram GPT out there. It's private.
Yeah, I'm building a Brent GPT too. So actually, David Veldren is
building
a Brent GPT. Poor guy is building a Brent GPT.
So we've got a Vikram GPT working, and I've been asking it questions. It's surreal. I'm asking myself questions to see how it responds. And then so it's definitely not perfect, but it's getting there. It's getting better. But the interesting thing is, there's clearly algorithmic bias somehow in here, because it says things that I would not have said and that I will not say. And so I don't know where and how these systems are actually working, or how they're connecting dots, or maybe I don't know myself as well as it knows me, but there are some thoughts that come out that I would not imagine saying.
So let me ask though, is that things that you would never say, or things that you wouldn't, things that you actually disagree with, or things that are being said in ways that you wouldn't say them?
Both. Both have occurred. Yeah. Things I wouldn't say have definitely popped up, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And again, I don't know what dot they're connecting in order to get there. Some things specifically about climate change came out, and I was like, wait, what? I wouldn't have said that. But my guess is it's taking something I said about business ethics and something I've said about oil and gas production, and it's somehow it's connecting dots in ways that I haven't thought, but that I wouldn't and that I don't believe.
Well, I mean, that's not unlike, you know, the story of the Go, the program that played Go and beat the world champion, right? The world champion was really like unsettled by the fact that the algorithm was finding moves that he had never thought of and that actually no person had ever thought of, right? So yep. It's like this, that could be a big advantage at some point, but yeah, it can be pretty unsettling.
Yeah,
too.
It is unsettling. In fact, I will tell you, it influenced a little bit of one of my more recent posts I wrote. It was called Drill Baby Drill. And it was a controversial post because I said, look, and I know this is off topic because I'll be really brief, but it was saying, look, a call for U.S. hydrocarbon production, unleash it, because A, it's going to lower inflation by bringing in prices for commodities. B, it'll take resources away from our enemies. Russia, Iran will have fewer resources if oil prices fall. And C, it will help the environment. And people are like, what? Hydrocarbon production help the environment? Yes, because U.S. oil production will crowd out oil production that might take place in Indonesia, Kazakhstan, or some other third world nation that doesn't have environmental regulations. And so we will actually capture methane. We will not dispose drilling fluids in our drinking water. And the environment will be better off because of oil production in America.
So this is an interesting example of where generalist knowledge is so important to making a decision or to making an argument around a topic that you're not particularly an expert in energy policy, right? But you understand these trade-offs, right? That's the that's what generalists are, some generalists, many of them are able to do. They're like, you know, you squeeze the balloon over here, that sounds good, but you know it's going to pop out on the other side, and you need to be aware of what that is, even if you make a decision that it's worth it, right?
That's right.
It may in fact be worth the trade-off, but always being aware of the trade-offs, I think, is really critical.
Yeah, and then Brent, one of the things I talk about in this book, The Making of a Generalist, is the class I taught at Harvard, which was really a systems thinking class, and really the way I describe it is the way I taught it, which is lenses, loops, and lags. And that's actually what I think a generalist does when thinking about these tough problems. Lenses, economics, politics, technology, social, other dynamics. Loops, exactly what you're talking about. What's the feedback loop? If I do something here, what's it going to do over here? How's it going to impact there? And we can still do it. We should just be aware that it's happening. And then lags. When will that impact happen? If we change education policy today, please don't expect a change in the workforce tomorrow. There is a lag. If you change, you know, trading policy today, well, that lag might be shorter in terms of investor behavior tomorrow. So, you know, that type of stuff. But systems thinking.
It's all like this massive hydraulic system.
Yes.
You know, where the pressure changes over here and then it does really weird things over here, and that feeds back into the, you know, the other part of the system that generated the change to begin with. So yeah it's it's a real thing. And because we're all pointillists when it comes to knowledge these days, there's just a real, blinders thing going on where people don't even want to acknowledge that challenge exists.
Yeah, it's also, Brent, I will tell you, and again, I don't want to overly harp on this one example of using this class at Harvard, but, you know, this, I think, captures what you're getting at. I would often, one of the cases we taught was inequality. Okay, so big challenge, disruptive socially, disrupts governments and countries. And so I would ask the students, what's the solution for inequality? And all of them initially was, well, it's education. So great, let's fix education. How are you going to do that? This poor area doesn't have the resources. Oh, well, you know, we got to give them more resources. Well, where do the resources come from? They come from property taxes, often locally. So you want to take from the rich districts and give to the poor districts? Is that what you're saying? Well, I'm not sure we want to do that because people bought into those. Okay, great. Well, what do you want to do, a statewide tax or a federal tax, and then push it down? There's bureaucracy. You lose some. There's inefficiencies. And, you know, you go down this path, and ultimately inequality, which students thought was an education issue, turns into a real estate housing issue, turns into a tax redistribution issue. And suddenly they're like, okay, it's more complicated than I thought.
and it ultimately turns into a social friction issue because people don't like having their money taken away from them and given to people they don't know. And so you get Prop 13 in California back in the 70s to not do that. You know, cap property taxes because we're, you know, we're sick and tired of it. We're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right.
So, Vikram, I want to ask you, it's fine to sort of talk about we need to be more generalist, but we also know that people are coming out of this context where they've been trained their entire lives to narrow, and to specialize. How did you get from a specialist culture into a generalist culture?
A journey orientation leads to more fulfillment than a destination orientation, right? Like if you're oriented towards, I have to get to this objective outcome. Well, you may or may not get there. There's uncertainty in life. There's random developments. This skill may or may not be useful at that point in time when you have it to be able to exploit it. And so this destination focus is a recipe for disappointment.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're content on the journey, actually enjoying your day to day, exploring, hey, this is not interesting, but this is, that's not, that is, that could be fascinating and fulfilling. And I can tell you, I find something exciting, interesting, and stimulating every day,
right,
like in the paper or like, you know, I was fascinated by, you know, developments in Asian elections coming up or what's happening in technology in Silicon Valley or, you know, what's happening with the technology of batteries and what's happening with launching rockets or my goodness, there's so many fun, exciting, interesting topics that could be fulfilling and exciting. And
so what's the secret sauce then for cultivating that that journey mindset, helping people to cultivate journey mindset in their own lives, do you think?
Yeah, so I think, you know, early and often being uncomfortable and actually getting to the point of craving sort of difference, right, rather than the comfort of similarity.
Right.
I think there's something there.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like we talk about the dopamine rush phenomenon of social media, which is all about, you know, similar kind of thing, but it's actually sort of slow burn dopamine. I mean, like you're not getting the immediate hit, but that you're getting a lot of little ones over a long period of time.
So for me, and again, I don't know how representative I am here, Brent, but I tend to get that excitement from finding things I didn't know. Not from confirmatory evidence, but you know, evidence that suggests I'm wrong, right? As a generalist, you walk into every room knowing there's people that know more about everything than you do. And so I think it creates this natural curiosity, which is like, okay, so what do you do? Because you know more about what you do than I do if you're a specialist. And you know, you do that, I don't do that. So what do you know? And it just, I think it's more interesting, but again, I'm biased.
Yeah, so this I teach a class for AEI in the Summer Honors Program, and the title of it is More Than a Paycheck. And it's about sort of how do you find a vocational calling in life? Like, and the first question that I usually pose to the class, I ask them to think about what's the article that you never fail to read, that you stop and you read it, not because of what it's going to do for you or because it's part of, you know, I'm going to extract something out of this that is going to help me, but just because it's immediately interesting. It's always immediately interesting. It's never not interesting. Mm-hmm. And so you stop and you read it. I ask that question mainly because I think that that is a clue to vocational calling, right? It's like this, your task as an emerging adult is to find the thing that you will still be wanting to do in 10 years, right? The thing that's going to help you get out of bed in the morning, and you're not going to dread you dread your day because you're locked into something that doesn't really tie into those what I call durable or intrinsic interests that we all have, you know, the things that we return to over and over again just because it kind of strums something really deep inside us. But that's one of those, like, let's try to get at this question from an angle that you haven't sort of contemplated before. Yeah. You know, or another way of coming at this question is, you know, everybody here, you're all trust fund babies.
Do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want. What do you want to do? And the first response is, well, I want to travel. Well, like, okay.
Yeah.
Travel's great. All right. But I'm talking about what are you going to do to spend your life productively?
Yep.
In a productive way. And money is no object.
Yeah.
So what would you do?
Yeah. Interesting, Brent. So one of the ways I've dealt with this similar line of reasoning with students over the years is I often ask them, what do you do on a Sunday morning when you're on break? There's no term papers due. You're done with your coursework reading. What are you reading, watching, doing? What is it that you do? And interestingly enough, oftentimes there'd be like a student who claims to be interested in Wall Street as their career destination. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, you know, I don't really like to read Barron's. I don't really like to read financial journals. I'm kind of really a foreign affairs. It's a little more thoughtful, substantive. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, do you think maybe foreign affairs is of interest to you? Are you a global person? Because you're going into credit default swap trading on a U.S. domestic investment bank trading desk. Like, maybe that's not a great fit.
Yeah.
Like, if you actually figure out what you would do if you weren't told what to do.
Right. So, that person follows that path into, you know, credit default swaps, and it might be enough to sustain them for a few years, their interests, their learning. It's, you know, it's hard work. It's
lucrative.
And you're getting all the toys and, you know, you're accumulating, the material benefits. One thing I think goes underappreciated is that midlife crisis doesn't happen when you're 50. It happens when you're 30. which is 10 years after you've graduated, you've placed all of your bets, and now you're having to live with them. And you've placed your bets elsewhere in places that are not aligned to these durable interests.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of, there's a lot of discontent, I think, that rises out of that.
I think that's right. You know, the one thing that I am perhaps more optimistic about than might naturally meet the eye, I think that people can always change, Brent. Like, I really do believe in these adapting at different career inflection points. And so, you know, I have plenty of students that have bailed on Wall Street after 10 years, right around that same point that you're hitting, like, totally discontent.
Yeah.
And they've gone off to totally different things. And being willing to do that.
I agree. I think people can and do change and often do. But boy, the cost of change is high,
disruptive.
Much higher at 32 than it is at 22.
Yeah, I get it.
Just because, again, you've placed a lot of bets in your life about what you think you want, and it's not quite working out the way that you imagined.
Yeah. So. And unfortunately, given this sorting that's taken place, this social sorting that's taken place throughout, I would argue, America, may or may not be happening elsewhere, you start living with people in those similar silos, right? And so the Wall Street types are living with other Wall Street types, and they could be sort of together. And then suddenly that's their reality, and they don't really think about other possibilities. And, you know, you start living in these worlds where keeping up with the Joneses is, in fact, the sole objective. And I think it leads to a lot of, you know, unsatisfied people.
So
unfulfilled.
What do you make of this conversation in light of something like Maslow's hierarchies?
Yeah.
Hierarchy of well-being.
Well, we all need shelter and food, Brad.
Yeah, that's... we all need that. That's and especially in the American context.
Look, I think it's interesting when you think about it from those hierarchy of needs. And, you know, it seems to be a very first world problem to actualize my potential in some way of a way, right? Whereas I think it's probably simpler to just keep that journey slash destination mindset and the journey is, in fact, the hierarchy that's higher. Like, we want to be more journey-oriented. Now, some people might have big loans, family obligations, you know, economic demands immediately, where they can't pursue some of these sort of fulfilling endeavors, so let's say. So I think there's a balancing act, but I think if we can get more people towards journey-oriented, then we're taking them up the hierarchy of needs, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. No,
maybe that's a simpler way to put it.
He did describe these things, each one of these things, each one of the levels of the hierarchy, as a need, right? What makes us think then that the need for at the top of the hierarchy is
lesser
than the needs at the bottom? You know, like.
Some are requirements. My read of it was you've got to start the bottom. You can't go to the second if you don't have the first.
Right. But this
no food or shelter. We're not.
But this midlife crisis thing that we've been talking about, that is an unmet need.
Yeah.
Within the hierarchy. So that's the way I've been thinking about it. And this is particularly a problem again in developed nations, especially the United States, where. You know, I guess you could starve to death in the United States, but I think it would be pretty hard. I mean, you'd have to really try. Mm-hmm. You'd have to, you know, because
but they're homeless.
Yeah, sure. But it's a $29 trillion economy with a pretty robust safety net. You know, the notion that, you know, that you aren't going to be able to survive, I think, is. You know, it's not going to be great, for sure. But, you know, that survival need is more or less, I think, off the table, right? So we've got, that's kind of taken care of. And I think that, you know, you look at something like male workforce disengagement, where men have really pulled out of the labor market in a way that we've never seen really before. That's made possible by this massive thing that we call the United States economy and our gross domestic product and the generosity of our safety nets and you can patch together a life, not a great one, but you can patch it together without working.
Yeah.
But again, what I say to kids who are in my class is just like, your burden is very different.
Oh, yeah. You know, yes, that's true.
You know, your problem is up here at the top of the hierarchy rather than down here at the bottom. You've got to generate all this meaning, you know.
Yes, that's true. That's definitely true. I would argue there's also, right, there needs to be more of a responsibility mindset to those that have these privileges of being up at, right? So I remember when I graduated from Yale University, and Yale's, I think, a little bit unique in this regard, and I don't know if they meant it, but I believed it. When you go through graduation, they say you are now being inducted into the, instead of rights and privileges, as they normally say, of being an alum for this university, Yale says the rights and responsibilities, which I really liked and I thought was a useful little twist on a overused phrase. But I also think there should be this sense of civic responsibility. And, you know, we don't really incorporate that into this hierarchy of needs, right? Like, I mean, part of the reason I ran for office is this itch to serve.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we don't spend nearly enough time on cultivating reciprocity and mutuality in the way we again, it's all part of the success mindset and that there's only a limited number of slots at the top. And so we're all scrambling to get there.
Yep. That's right.
And it's like, you know, take a breath here. Your problem is not survival. We're sort of, I think, kind of genetically selected species for danger and scarcity, and we're living in a time of plenty
abundance.
And security.
Yeah, that's right.
And our drives don't align well with our current environment because, you know, you can only compete so hard and so long, and, you know, finding those opportunities for service to be responsible to others, I think, is super important.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've done, going back to students and helping them think about this, because maybe this is useful, is I'll often ask them, don't talk to me about your career move for the next year, 5 years, whatever, what you're thinking about or what you're seeking guidance on. Let's write your obituary. It's something that other faculty have done. I don't think this was my idea. Write it. Let's see what you're going to write in there. Inevitably, it's about family, about impact on the world. It's about did this, invented that, was able to achieve this or that. Rarely is it about I was a managing director at so-and-so bank, or I did this and did that. It was always about impact. And I was like, okay, so that's the objective. Now let's talk about how you're getting there and what you're thinking about, right? Like, if you want to be a valued member of the community, okay, are you going to volunteer? Where does that fit into your career portfolio of activities?
Yeah.
What's most fulfilling to you?
So, I know this about you, and it's a part of our lives that are another similarity between us. But we've both got kids with special needs.
Yep.
I've got a son with autism. You have a daughter who has special needs. How should we be thinking about people who are not equipped for the race of life that a typical person has to engage in? What's our plan for them?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Brenton, and I'll just share my story with our daughter. You know, we were living in Lexington, Massachusetts, and this is a town with lots of resources. They had 20 or 30 experts around our IEP meetings, and each one would tell us what they were working on by themselves in their little silo. Very rarely did they talk about how they were integrating these perspectives. So right there, as a generalist, I'm already uncomfortable. But one thing I noticed was we were really having struggles with them focusing on that very question, which is, how do we get our daughter to be a member of society where she can contribute something and have a degree of independence and personal fulfillment, right? That's what our goal for her has been. And so we started getting into battles with, at one point, we were almost in a legal battle with them. And that's very uncomfortable, to be in a legal battle with your school, and yet we're taxpayers and they're fighting us, and it's just not a good situation. Well, it turns out we had been going up to New Hampshire, and we had a ski house up there, and my daughter had been thriving in this adaptive ski program. It's at the New England Disabled Sports Program at Loon Mountain. And there was an amazing community here. Now, Brent, the contrast is just overwhelming. Really well-to-do suburb of Boston with unlimited resources, 15 different experts around the table for an IEP meeting. When we finally gave up on that and decided to make New Hampshire our full-time home, I remember our first IEP meeting was with one woman who probably knew more about special needs than any of those experts down around the big table in Massachusetts, who looked at us, my wife and I, and said, Vikram, Kristen, you know your daughter best. What do we need to do to support her? And it was literally almost jerking a tear out of our eyes, because it was like, wow, this is actually a place that wants to support us. I concluded quickly, and then I'll get to answering your question. I concluded quickly that actually big government boxed out a lot of that community spirit. And we saw that because in New Hampshire, where there were not the resources that they had in this well-to-do suburb of Massachusetts, the community came together in ways that supported each other. So actually, my daughter knows more people in Lincoln, New Hampshire than I do. Skiing with her on the mountain, she introduces me to people. She introduces my wife to people. She introduces my son to people. She knows more people there. She's worked in town as a food service worker for summer jobs already. The community supports that. They give her a sense of purpose. And she's contributing in a way that's useful. So to me, I think there's a couple of different things that sort of come into play to answer your question of how do we support those who don't have the skills that many of us do. There still are roles. There still are roles. And by the way, we don't need to label them in a certain way that highlights where their limitations exist. They may have other skills, right? I'll give you another example with my daughter specifically. This was literally a tear-jerking moment for me. I walked into the New England Disabled Sports waiting room, and my daughter had been skiing multiple times. She knows everyone there. She's a comfortable skier. But there was a disabled vet who just showed up, back from Afghanistan, double amputee, who was visibly nervous about going out to ski as a seated skier. And my daughter noticed his discomfort and went up to him and said, "Hi, I'm a skier. Are you going to be a skier?" Mm-hmm. And he was a little bit nervous. And she said, "You can do it. No problem. Everyone here is going to help you. Mm-hmm. I did it. You're going to be fine." Mm-hmm. And it was so disarming coming from her that this vet, who had been one of America's heroes fighting on the front lines, you know, lost both his legs, was suddenly smiling. And so everyone has something to contribute. Finding what they can contribute and where, I think, is part of what we as a society can do to help them. But I do think there's lots of opportunities. Finding the right place where they can thrive is better than a mindset that says we have to fix these individuals.
I think that's a great place for us to wrap up on this, because whether an individual has a disability, doesn't have a disability, they've all got the same challenge of finding that place in life where they can both give and receive at the same time, because that is what fulfills us as human beings, allows us to express our humanity and to be part of this great, you know, experiment and reciprocal behaviors that define what it is to be human. So, Vikram, great having you. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, and look forward to continuing to follow your journey.
Oh, I appreciate that, Brent. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Hardly Working. I'm your host, Brent Orrell, and I hope you tune in next time to learn more about the state of workforce development in America. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast. Let us know at vocation@aei.org if there are any topics you'd like us to cover. As always, we hope you find the job that fits so well, it feels like you're hardly working.